China, isn't at the G7 in Cornwall right now. It may be the second richest country in the world by GDP, but it has a relatively low rate of wealth per person. And that fact is part of the reason for disillusionment with the Chinese economic dream, which is encountering an obstacle that has nothing to do with an ageing population or a lack of innovation. There's a mass movement afoot among young people protesting not just their bleak personal economic prospects, but also the whole ethos of work hours that leave them exhausted and the skyrocketing prices of homes they will never be able to afford. It's called the lying flat movement because lying flat is their response, staying in bed instead, if you like. And it began, or is said to have begun, with an online post called Lying Flat is Justice. An anonymous user named Kind-Hearted Traveller quoted the Greek philosophers on how to live a good life and compared that with his own situation, living on the New Zealand equivalent of $45 a month, being 2 years without work, having not enough to eat. And the post was wiped by authorities, but the idea had already caught on. Other ways to lie flat include not getting married and starting a family, or just rejecting jobs with overtime involved, or where you have to sit at a desk. Joining us again from Beijing on Sunday morning is Nathan Vanderclip, who covers Asia for Canada's biggest daily newspaper, The Globe and Mail. Good morning, Nathan.
Hello.
Nice to talk. Does China care about missing out on the G7?
It cares in the sense that China feels like it should be at these tables. It cares in the sense that it has, in state media and official commentary, you've seen China trying to downplay the importance of the G7, saying, you know, this was a group of nations that at one point had some sort of economic leadership in the world, but that has changed and that it's no longer as important. So there's been a real effort to sort of downplay the importance of the G7. So I suppose all of that could be an indication that China's unhappy that it's not included. But of course, all of these things have gotten far beyond mere economic questions. And China, of course, is cognizant of the fact that the U.S. and other countries are pushing back ever more vigilantly against China, and forums like the G7 have been places where some of that effort has taken place to create sort of a broader international effort to push back against things that are happening in China. So in that sense, China obviously does care because it's not keen to see anybody ganging up against it.
Yes, and it's outside that tent. I'll get back to the G7, but Nathan, this lying flat movement reported in many major media, it's said to have authorities worried. Do you think they are at all?
Well, there was the kind of response you would get when authorities are worried, which is that discussion was just completely shut down, scrubbed from the internet. Groups that had popped up to discuss this notion just vanished. You had official media, you had the Communist Youth League and others writing things to disparage it. So in that sense, I suppose, there's an official concern. I mean, my sense of this is that the concern is not so much about this particular meme and what it encapsulates, but the concern is about the underlying issue here, which is if there is any sense that a younger generation of Chinese is coming up and is concerned that the future is not getting better, and is concerned that tomorrow is unlikely to be better than today, and is concerned that the way this country has developed over the last 30 or 40 years has created inequities that for younger people it seems nearly impossible to get past. I mean, those are structural issues, and those are reflected in sort of the emergence of not just this meme, but a series of others over the last couple of years. The way China has succeeded and not succeeded in creating an economy and social structure that works or does not work for its people.
Because there's always been that trade-off, hasn't there? No democracy, state control, command economy, but in return, happiness through prosperity, more all the time. And now that's being rejected among some of the young.
Well, I mean, prosperity, relative prosperity. And let's not forget that at the outset of reform and opening up, there was this idea from Deng Xiaoping of letting some get rich first. And of course, that's happened. China's minting billionaires at a world-leading pace. But at the same time, you've had just these enormous economic difficulties that have emerged for all kinds of people. You have something like 600 million people in China that are still making under 1,000 RMB per month. And that's, what, $150, something like that. You have places like Shenzhen, China's tech capital, which is the kind of place that people go, you know, are super impressed by it because it has these really important high-tech companies. But at the same time there, if you compare a two-bedroom apartment with your average salary, you're looking at 43 years of that average salary. Wow. To be able to purchase. And of course, you know, we look at what's happening in property markets in our countries, in New Zealand and Canada and elsewhere, and there are deep concerns there. But even in some of those very hot property markets in Western countries, you don't see those kind of numbers. And so you can see if you're a young person, and you know, you've also had this rise in the last number of years of this 996 culture, which has been quite famous and infamous in the tech sector in China, working from 9 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock in the evening, 6 days a week. And so you've got people who are being effectively forced into working punishing overtime hours for salaries that aren't enough to really accomplish much. Meanwhile, their parents' generation, many of them received housing either for free or for massively discounted pricing, and then have sort of ridden those housing prices upwards. So you have real generational inequity that's taking place here. And now a new generation's coming in and is wondering what's left for it.
And you couple that, don't you, with what's called the emerging class system, because some of the grumbles that you read from the younger people is that the jobs go to better connected students who get them within weeks of graduation, sons of business people, daughters of high officials, and there are only the crumbs left for all these graduates who face those poor salaries that you describe.
In absolutely massively competitive situations, trying to get ahead in any way. I recently did an article in which I surveyed some Chinese students at a Canadian university, and I was trying to get a sense of where they see greater opportunity as they look forward after graduating in Canada. Do they see greater opportunity in Canada or in China? And, you know, there were, of course, views on different sides. But one of the ones that I wasn't expecting to hear was that there were some who said, you know, it's better for us to stay in Canada because having not been in China for the last number of years, having not attended university in China, we simply don't have the connections to be able to get good jobs there. That, of course, produces a sense of despair.
Jack Ma of Alibaba called that 996 culture that you talked about, in other words, a 72-hour work week, a blessing. I don't think we in the West understand why he would say that.
Well, it's certainly a blessing for him. We have to have workers working on a 996 schedule. I mean, there is this belief that's hardwired, I think, into a generation of Chinese entrepreneurs that it is only by the virtue of their own hard work that they were able to get ahead and that they were able to sort of build up these gargantuan companies. And so there is this lionization, this deification of the idea of hard work for the sake of hard work and hard work being really the tool for everything. The question, if you're a 20-year-old, is who is my 996 benefiting? Is it benefiting me or is it benefiting my billionaire boss?
Yeah. Yes. So the lying flat attitude, there's a lot of buying into it on places like the microblogging site Weibo. 60% of a quarter of a million respondents said they wanted to embrace lying flat, which is not scientific, but it does illustrate a level of discomfort and rejection. And does it sow problematic seeds for the future? I mean, birth control is easing, but this sort of attitude towards having children, for example, could help derail it. Or do you think it's just a perennially recurring, not much will happen as a result phenomenon?
Well, I think a lot of these things are actually quite tightly interwoven, because one of the reasons that birth controls are being eased is because China is trying to boost its number of babies because it sees a demographic structure that is going to have more and more older people relying on the efforts and economic productivity of fewer and fewer younger people, and they're trying to alter that. But one of the reasons that so few younger people are willing to have more children, I mean, even after they got rid of the one-child policy and made it a universal two-child policy, there was very little change in birth rates. In fact, birth rates have continued to decline. And that's simply because for many, there is just no, for many young parents, there's just no ability to see how they would afford to have a second child. So a lot of these things are interrelated. And I think these get at really fundamental questions for China. I mean, there's a whole science, as it turns out, about happiness. And China has been surveyed for many years in terms of the average happiness levels of its people. And even as its economy has increased and increased and increased at this breakneck pace, its happiness levels have barely budged. And in fact, in the fastest growth years in China in the 90s, happiness in China sank precipitously. And it's kind of since recovered. But on a 10-point scale, China is roughly at about a 5. And it's statistically unhappier than even much poorer countries. You know, you look at an El Salvador, a Moldova, a Kazakhstan, you know, people in those places say that they are happier than people in China. And I think this is a really fundamental issue for China's leadership. They've been very successful in creating aggregate economic growth in terms of the overall GDP number. They've been less successful on GDP per capita. And I think they've been even less successful on some of those measures of people's own sense of well-being.
Well, it's a fascinating recipe for something in the future. Nathan van der Klip is with us. The G7 nations always express concern about what's happening in China's northwest, and the use of tiger chairs with leg irons and handcuffs, beatings and torture, sleep deprivation. China's Uyghurs live in a dystopian hellscape, says Amnesty International in this big report in the last couple of days. It's pulled no punches. You are very aware of the Uyghur situation. You've written quite a bit about it. Will China take any notice of what others are saying now at all?
If it does, it certainly won't say as much. I mean, what we'll hear from China is what we've heard from China for years now, that China believes that it has effectively constrained extremism and terrorism in Xinjiang, and that in doing so, it has created an environment of happiness for all. I think, you know, there's all kinds of data to suggest that that is not true, and in fact, that the opposite may be true. But what we'll see from China is what we've seen over the years, which is a continued progression of a course that was probably set to move in that direction anyway, where we had mass incarceration of people, you had forcible political indoctrination of large numbers of people. From there, you had large numbers of people moved into factory settings, both in Xinjiang and in other parts of the country. At the same time, large numbers of people placed into formal prisons, and still a regime in Xinjiang that continues to be very, very oppressive for many people who are considered suspicious by the state.
Annexing Tibet gave Beijing, didn't it, a successful template?
You've clearly had a deep, deep sense of discontent that has been expressed in Tibet over many decades. I think you see something very similar that's taking place in Xinjiang. I mean, I suppose you have to ask, what is success? How do you define success? And who defines success? I think there's all kinds of ways that you can look at the sort of life and liberty that people in those places are experiencing and come to, I think, a very different conclusion.
Oh, yes, I was using success from the point of view of the Chinese Communist Party, but it seems to be being attempted on a much larger scale with the Uyghur population and moving Han Chinese into that area and trying to do what has been done in the past. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, and that continues. And in fact, that idea of moving Han Chinese to Xinjiang has increased in terms of, you know, the way a government priority, the incentives that are being created to have people move out there, incentives to have property, to have land, to have benefits for children in terms of university placement testing and all those sorts of things. They're all being rolled out in an effort to have Han Chinese move out to Xinjiang and change the population ratios, or as the Chinese say, in what I think is sort of an eerily kind of corporate term, to optimize the population structure. And so that's what they're trying to do. I think they've seen mixed success on that because they've also seen large numbers of Han Chinese move out of Xinjiang, which has become a very difficult place over the last number of years to live. You know, freedoms of movement and other things have been very different in Xinjiang than they have been other parts of China. And so you've seen people moving with their feet, but the state, of course, is working to reverse that.
It's not going exactly the way that they want it to in Beijing, is it? Just a quick question before we go. Do you know where the elephants? I think everybody knows about the wandering elephants by now. Do you know where they are at the moment?
They're around Kunming. They're still media stars. They're still attracting millions. I mean, not just millions, hundreds of millions of views to their videos of these, you know, these cute baby elephants walking around and stumbling around and falling into irrigation canals and lakes and all the rest. It's quite a thing, these elephants. 15 of them just captured the whole nation.
It is quite a thing, and a happier note to end on. Nathan Vanderclip, thank you very much. Always a pleasure to talk.
You're very welcome.